Welcome to Tales of a Per Entrepreneur with your host, Dr. Biz, aka Jamie Reeves. Welcome to Tales of a Per Entrepreneur, a podcast that tells the stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And if you're a business owner and parent, I salute you, as they're two of the hardest things you can do, and you are doing both together. I'm your host, Jamie Reeves, aka Dr. Biz, and on today's episode is a couple who successfully coached men and women in the field of mindset and relationships for many years. Martin, a former pro footballer, and Naomi, a former midwife, lead a busy family life. With four children between them, they know what the stresses and strains busy parenting life can bring, and how easy it is to put yourself at the bottom of the list. With years of experience helping men and women maintain relationships with each other, they now also focus on helping individuals understand and create a deeper connection with themselves to resolve the challenges they face in everyday life. Naomi and Martin are huge believers that anyone can achieve their goals with a certain mindset. So please, welcome to Tales of a Per Entrepreneur, Naomi Jordan and Martin Pemberton. Good morning, guys.
Hey, what an intro.
Well, welcome. I'm loving that.
Thank you very much.
So how are you both?
Very well.
Yeah, we're good.
Well, I'm going to delve straight into it with a question for you, Martin, to start with.
Yeah.
So how do you go from the very masculine world of football into helping coach mindset and relationships for both men and women?
Right, well, I'll try and do it as quickly as I can. So, being a pro footballer for such a long time, of course, there's a lot of perks to that. It's a great thing to kind of achieve. I think along the way, you don't always realise the toll that it can take on you as well. So then, when I retired back in 2007, a lot of life changes that I did in a very quick amount of time, which I don't recommend other people do, but that had a massive effect on my mental health to the point where I was suicidal, and that's almost like 10, 11 years ago now. So I've been able to recover from that. Recovering from that, I discovered that there were a few things that were common within that recovery period that I wasn't doing when I wasn't feeling great. There happened to be 11 players on a pitch. If you win your battles 1 to 11, that's how that kind of premise came. But then from that, it was a transition into then wanting to help people initially manage their own mental health and recover from those things. But when what we realised was that the foundation to everybody's well-being is the quality of our relationships. When your relationships are nice, strong and secure, whoever they're with, it doesn't always have to be romantically, that gives us a real foundation to improve and maintain a real sense of well-being. So it kind of just transitioned through that process.
So do you think then that lots of footballers who come out of that big kind of squad environment where they've got lots of relationships, then when you retire, you're suddenly on your own? Do you think that's a common frailty amongst former pros then?
Yeah, I think you live in a certain world. I think there's a certain way of being that is not the same in the real world, as I call it, not in the football world. So when you lose that support system of people that you've been around that are into the same things as you, that have the same maybe goals, aspirations, to come out of that can feel very lonely. The other thing as well is that your sense of identity, your self-worth, is all wrapped up in what you do, not who you are. And along the way, you forget that and you slip into, I'm a footballer, isn't that great? But then you forget there's a person behind that. And I think the processes as well going through a football career is people see you as just a footballer, will treat you as such maybe on the pitch with things that they might say, which they're entitled to do, but there's still a person behind that person doing that job. So when all that falls away, there's a deep sense of loss. And it was something that I never really considered in terms of there's a grieving process that you wouldn't associate with changing a career, but actually loss is loss, and if you lose something that's really dear to you, it's going to have an effect on you. And I didn't realise it at the time. It's only going through the process and then learning to coach other people and seeing that in its entirety, that's something that people are struggling with all the time, is there's always something that we end up losing which has an effect on us. But to have these relationships in place and how we view our relationships is paramount then to how we feel, not only while we're in those relationships, but also if those relationships come to an end as well.
Yeah. So I'm going to switch it now to Naomi. You were a midwife. So how did you then change with having all that kind of camaraderie that you've got in the hospital to then being a business owner where it's lots and lots of people to very few people, especially when you first start out. So how did you cope with that change?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the same as, you know, you say about football and a team. When you do work in a place like, again, the NHS, then you do have to become a very tight-knit unit, don't you, with your colleagues. You're dealing with a lot of stressful situations, and you have to sort of trust and rely on people. So again, it's that relationship element. So then coming out of that, I went into setting up a different business to the one I'm doing now, because I had my own children. So it was tricky delivering other people's babies and trying to balance my own, what with childcare and weekends and nights, etc. So I set up my own childminding business. So I've had this steady transition from being part of a team there to becoming my own sort of boss as a childminder. My own little team then became the children that I surrounded myself with, plus the parents. But then transitioning into this, yes, absolutely. All along, though, I think that whatever you do and whatever job capacity you're in, you learn a lot about yourself. So whilst you are maintaining relationships with other people is really key, managing and maintaining that relationship with yourself is equally as important, because that's who you take everywhere. So as your confidence grows, as your self-esteem grows, yes, you still require other people to be around you for support and help, but you also have more trust and sort of faith in yourself, because like I say, as your confidence grows, you are then okay to maybe work alone, knowing that you can call on other people, but you don't maybe depend and rely on them as much. So it's been a really fascinating transition, not just from learning about others, but learning about yourself as well.
Yeah, because it seems that you've both had that transition from being in large squads, large teams, to then kind of being a lot more insular.
Yeah.
So during that transition, what are the biggest things that you've both learned about yourselves?
Ooh. I think that you are more capable than you think you are. And we sometimes talk about this. When it comes to the mind, it'll tell you all sorts of stuff. It'll tell you what you can't do, what you're not good at, what you don't like, or what you don't want. And actually, when it comes to the mind, sometimes you can't trust it 100%. Yeah. Question it. Because actually, you are a lot more capable than you think you are. You've got a lot of beliefs running that you've picked up through childhood. My favorite one that I've shifted is that I was shy and quiet, and I never used to talk, ever. Wouldn't talk, would hate to be put on the spot to be asked questions like this, would clam up, would go red. And I've had to work on that one now. And now I sit here chatting. I mean, Martin wishes I could probably reverse that one and maybe stop talking a little bit. But you have to start to challenge yourself and question the things that you say about yourself to realise that actually You are a lot more capable. So that's the one thing I would say. I've learned that I'm a lot more capable than I thought I was.
Yeah. Mm. It's really similar. I think you go through challenging times in life, and it gives you that confidence to know that you can do hard things and you can come back from hard things. And I think the other thing we've learned is, though, that most of it's built on your own self-esteem. So like I said earlier, all my self-esteem was wrapped up in a role, in a job. And actually what I've learned is that your self-esteem is built within who you are. And if you can get that right and work with yourself on that, then you can handle the other things that then come into your life. You know, people talk about having confidence or a lack of confidence. And we always say to people, confidence is a skill in a certain area or thing that you do. It's not who you are. But if your self-esteem is high and you've built that, even if you're not confident, you'll still go and attempt something because you're not scared to fail. And I think that's something that we've both worked on that's enabled us to go from those settings that we were in before, to learn from going through that, to then becoming individuals, but then starting to work together and helping people kind of work through their relationships with all the challenges that life brings as well. I think once you go through a lot of things and you come out the other side, you get less scared of going through other things, don't you? So we always try to encourage people to have the courage to face that thing that you're scared about, because actually the confidence you'll get from doing it is so empowering, and it just gives you that foundation that then you can move forward a lot easier and face the challenges that are going to inevitably arise, you know?
Yeah, it's that animal instinct in our brain, isn't it? Have you ever read Steve Peters, the Chimp Paradox?
Yeah.
It's
dates back to kind of prehistoric days when we were hunters and we were worried about being attacked by saber-toothed tigers, that the negative part of our brain is still doing that in the 21st century and trying to protect us from all those things when it's not really a true story. Mm-hmm. And confidence for me is just putting in the reps.
Yeah.
I remember when I first started singing, going back to 1997, doing Haven's kind of training course that you do before you go out to the season. And I had to sing for half a minute in front of all my peers. Now, I'd never really sung since I was at school in plays and stuff. So that first half a minute, it looked as if I was waving to my mum with the microphone because I was wobbling it that much. And I was doing the world's best Elvis impression because my knees were knocking and just kind of bending in so bad. But now, if I go out and do a gig now, I will just grab the microphone, walk out and do it. Because I've put those reps in. And Arnie talks a lot about this in his last book. If you put the reps in, then that's kind of what you will kind of get out.
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely.
So we're thinking about mindset and how things can help, confidence can help you. But how do you teach that to people that come to you that are feeling a little bit lacking?
When we talk relationships, lots of people then think it's those relationships with other people. Now, as cheesy as it sounds, and I know it gets bandied around a lot, it's the relationship that you have with yourself that's the key one. So we actually turn the light back onto the people. People come to us with problems, and they are, you know, talking about things that are outside of themselves, which, yes, absolutely, these things come along to challenge us. When you work on that relationship with yourself, when we start to unpick it and we take them through this program, a step-by-step program that starts to get them to look at themselves inside. You know, what is it that you're not okay with? What's the actual problem for a start? Because a lot of people come with something and the thing that they come with is never actually the problem. It's how we're thinking about the problem that's the thing. But how come, where's that come from? We take them through this program and we identify the beliefs that are running behind it. And it's a lovely process to watch people go through as they start to then understand themselves that little bit more. Because once you understand yourself and why you react the way you react and what it is that you're thinking about the thing, you'll be like, oh, right, okay, now I understand. And once you understand, you can then do something about it, can't you? You know what you're changing then. You know what you need to challenge and you know what it is that's actually causing you the biggest problem.
Can you just talk about it in sense of it's like self-inquiry but without guilt, blame or shame? Because that's another thing that people go through when they start to discover then there's elements of shame and guilt that can come up for things that they weren't responsible for maybe back in the past. But what we always try to help people understand is, although you might not be responsible for those things and you can't necessarily change them, you can change the meaning of them, but it's still our responsibility from now to move forward. And we always talk about acceptance of things and it not being resignation. It's just being able to say, that's happened. I might not have liked it. I might not have liked who I was at that point in time, but I don't have to be that person now. And would I have done anything different anyway? Who knows? Yeah. But it's about empowering people. But to be able to do that, it's that shining that light on yourself, like Naomi said. But again, without the shame and guilt and feeling terrible about yourself, it's kind of like saying, I didn't know any better at the time, but now I know better, I'm going to try and do something different.
Yeah. Do you think that education does enough to empower young people and set us on the right path from an early age?
No, not really. I'll be honest, I don't think that children are being educated enough when it comes to themselves, relationships, and the sort of responsibility side of stuff, and I think it's disempowering. Yes, they're teaching them what they need to know to maybe pass exams and things, but to function maybe in day-to-day life, probably there could be a little bit more.
Relationship building and maintaining is probably the most important skill that any of us can learn, because like you said, back in the day you needed to stay in the tribe to survive. So the fact that it's probably the most important thing, but we're all not very good at it because we don't get taught it from an early age. That's why I would say that's why in schools, if we could start to teach this at a really early age. And again, it gives people the opportunity to understand themselves, because when you understand yourself, you can see there's not many differences between you and other people. So it gives you more compassion, more understanding, which means then there's a smaller bridge to kind of cross to make up with people, or to stop grudges and things like that. But obviously we don't get taught those things because we're learning lots of other things, which, you know, might be mm-hmm. needed in life. But I think the basic human skills would be better taught earlier on, and then you move into those academic things later on. For mm-hmm. me anyway, that's...
Well, I think to teach children emotional regulation to yeah. understand themselves sets them up to learn other stuff anyway. If you've got children that aren't able to emotionally regulate or understand themselves, yeah. they're not going to take the best from the learning environment of school anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard because sometimes as an adult, I find it hard to kind of
Absolutely.
Keep my emotions under control. Yeah. That yeah. I'm not known as a Jack Russell in my office for yeah. nothing. Hopefully when I do something wrong, I'm quick to apologise and right my wrongs.
Yeah.
So for kids, it's even harder. So yeah. how do you teach that to your children?
We very much, it's called like co-regulation. So it's not necessarily what you say, it's what you do. So children are lovely, they're little sponges, aren't they? And to model the behaviour that you wish to see, whilst allowing them to get it wrong and mess up, because we all yeah. do, like you say, we all react. And I always think it's not necessarily in the reaction, it's how quickly we can overcome it afterwards and understand yeah. it. Because sometimes, gosh, something could go wrong and you can hang on to it for days, weeks, months, years, can't you? But it's more so in the transition and the turnaround of, oh, do you know what? Yeah, I didn't probably handle that to the best that I could have.
Yeah.
How come? What am I going to do differently? On all of this. So it's when it comes to the kids, because we've got four between us, all girls as well. Lucky Martin is all girls. He's in an all-female environment.
I have to do a lot of internal work.
Yeah.
There's
a lot of hormones flying. So we've got two teenagers, yeah. and then an 11-year-old and a 9-year-old. It's about modelling the behaviours that you wish to see, whilst also allowing them to do how they do, but being open and all right, talking about it yeah. after.
I think one of the yeah. other things as well we do, because when you go through school and through your life, you're built into a system of reward and punishment.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, if they come to us with a drawing and they ask us what we think of it, we always ask them what they think of it, because if you think you've done a really good drawing and then your dad tells you it's not very good, you're going to be absolutely gutted, right? But what if you're happy with it? And then you go, oh, yeah, actually. And it's not that you shouldn't ask people for their opinion, but it's teaching them that self-validation and self-acceptance is the actual key to moving forward. Because if I need someone to tell me that I'm doing well all the time, but if my doing well is not good enough for them, I'm always going to feel like a failure, right? And that's the system that we've all been born into, mm-hmm. where you're always seeking validation from outside. So then when that transitions its way all the way through to adulthood, well, then we'll work with adults who are still seeking approval, because why wouldn't we? that we have to mm-hmm. even teach that to, for them to accept themselves, to know that what they're doing is good enough for them right now, and that if other people don't like it, don't approve of it, that's still okay as well.
Okay, they're allowed.
But that's a difficult thing when you've been programmed to seek it, to then go against your programming, to go, oh my God, what if my dad don't like it or my mum? To say to yourself, well, I'm going to be okay whether mum or dad likes it or not, because I'm happy with it, that's the process that you go through that takes a little bit of time. But by doing that, you know, you've got that self-esteem where you're confident in your own decision-making. And then you've got a different human being then, you know. But that's we don't know this stuff, so we've all been trained to be programmed to seek it from elsewhere, which means you very rarely can be happy. So we want
to... Yeah, it's almost like having a black belt in mindset is that unfuckwithable kind of bit where, that you want to get to, where
yeah.
it doesn't matter what people say about you or what you do,
yeah,
you don't care, because as long as you feel good inside,
yeah.
that's what matters. And yeah. as long as you're doing right
yeah.
by yourself and doing right by others, then that should only ever be be the kind of highest level goal, really, shouldn't it?
That's huge for kids to learn. Yeah. So, you know, they come back and so-and-so says this and so-and-so, and I'm going to... The older ones more so, but people are allowed to say whatever they are allowed to say it. It's up to you and how you manage that, and that comes from a level of the self-esteem that you have. People will have an opinion on you and anything that you do, and they are allowed, and they will come at it from their own place of, well, I wouldn't do that. What are they doing that for? And absolutely, we've all done that, haven't we? Like, what are they doing that for? But that's just my opinion, and I'm allowed that, but I'm also going to allow that person to carry on and do, you know, as they wish. But that's a tricky one, isn't it? Being okay with people not liking you. I know I've had to work on that one when it comes to putting stuff out on social media and getting over the fear of that.
But we always say about that, do you like everybody?
Yeah, we do.
And no, you don't. So, so you've got, you know, it swings and roundabouts. If you don't like everybody, it's safe to assume that not everybody's going to like you. That's all right. I think that's the key part, is saying that that's...
And I'm okay
that's
with that.
That's all right. Yeah. I think something you mentioned before, Jamie, I was just thinking about the self-esteem. When your self-esteem's high, and we talk to people about this, it's the knowledge that you're no better or worse than anyone else. And that's kind of it, because then if you think you're better than someone else, you'll try and make that apparent, which is not high self-esteem, and it's not confidence either. But it's also not that, oh my God, everyone else is better than me, I'm rubbish. It's knowing that you are you, and you are no better or worse. Everyone's special. That's what you say, like, you're special, you are, just like everybody else. And that helps you then to maintain your level of how you want to be when you interact with people, because you might have more knowledge, you might have more skill in a certain area, but again, what you do is not who you are. And I think people can get caught up in being good at something, then automatically elevates them to be a better person just because you're good at something. And that's certainly something from the past that can come into, like, with sport or being a professional footballer or sports person. That ego can drive yourself to think that just because you kick a football around, you're somehow a better person than maybe the person who does another kind of job. But actually, it's the understanding that you're just good at that thing.
Yeah.
But you're the same as a person. We're all individuals, but we're on that kind of level, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So, with running a business together and having four kids, how do you find that business, work life and home balance?
Well, I think luckily we get on well outside of work as well, which obviously doing the job we do, it would help, doesn't it? But I think that's one thing that's made it easier, I think, is that we are very much aligned in our values in terms of how we are as people, you know, different subjects, whether that's kids, finances, just different things. So us being aligned in that makes it a little bit easier to then work together, because you understand the demands and requirements for each person, which then helps us to share the load, which then makes things run a lot smoother, you know.
Planning. The week. We also, and I know we work with a lot of couples, and what we try and encourage them to do is remove any job roles that they've decided is boy job, girl jobs. This is what we joke about, because that then, like Martin says, if something needs doing, one of us will just do it. It's not, oh, that's Martin's job to do, or that's Naomi's job to do. If it's the cooking of the tea or taking bins out or just putting the washing away, whoever's not working or whoever's not with the kids takes on that role. So when it comes to managing kids and businesses and works, just have a look at what you have decided that you have to do, and that's your job, because actually then that creates a bigger workload for one sometimes, which then builds the resentment and the argument. So take away jobs. I mean, we do joke, Martin jokes sometimes when I say something like, oh, could you just go grab the washing out of the thing? And he's like, oh, Naomi, we don't get taught that at boy school. Like, boy school doesn't teach us to do the washing.
Jamie knows.
He knows that that's not taught at boy school.
And my wife will tell you I know as well.
Yeah, but when we joke about it, and when we joke about it with couples, they're like, oh, okay, we get that. But just by removing whose job it is, it helps to manage a very busy sort of schedule.
I almost feel like over the weekend, my daughter's in a show in Manchester coming up, so my wife has been back and forth to there. So I ended up cooking tea Saturday and Sunday, and it was always like, I need a gold star for that.
Yeah, you wear a cape.
That's manpower.
Yeah, that's it. He puts a Martin towel. Sometimes drapes a towel around him like his cape, and then he walks around house going, "Only me working, girls. It's only me working like that." But it's all done in jest, and it's funny. But it highlights sometimes actually where problems can come up.
Yeah, I think
some people are unwilling to maybe
on the other side of that. I think it's important for our girls to see that those jobs are shared. Because as they're growing up, then my mum and dad used to remember them cleaning the house together on like a Saturday morning. So in my mind, that just translated from seeing my dad into, oh well, that's what you do. Do you know what I mean? So again, it's teaching everybody that there are no specific jobs, and actually, if you can all muck in and do different ones, then as a team, then that it helps everything to run much smoother, and obviously cooperation, we're always talking about that with everybody in terms of, and again, it's not cooperating to bend over backwards to do stuff you don't want to do because you've got to still, you know, feel valid and stuff, but can you cooperate with people to the best of your ability to get the job done, which obviously Naomi learned in her early career, and I had
you
to do in my
team,
career,
yeah.
You know?
You're your own little team, aren't you?
I think as soon as there's more than one person, that's a community. Again, going back to that, getting along for safety, you've got to find a way to get along with people. And so for people in schools, the greatest skill you can teach people is how to build and maintain relationships, because thinking of when you leave school, how many opportunities have you had through a relationship that you might have built years ago, or someone comes back into your life because, and the way that you acted then gave you an opportunity down the line.
The reason we're talking today is because of a relationship I had with a coach 7-8 years ago in Jay Allen, who was on the podcast weeks back, who introduced us, and now we're having this conversation. So hello, Jay, very thankful.
<There you go. laughs>
So systems and processes and automation for your business, yours is quite a hands-on, I guess, doing at the time business. So how do you automate stuff, and how do you build those systems and processes to make that work-life balance a little bit easier?
That's in process, you know, learning how to do that. So as the business has grown, you have to grow with the business, don't you, to start to get things in place and set up just to make life a lot easier. But that's been a challenge tech-wise, you know, learning it all behind the scenes. But getting things in place is definitely... Hell, I always think if something becomes a problem or a struggle, instead of just keep doing the same stuff over and over and making it more of a problem, what needs to change? And it's that sort of being open to change and willingness to learn new stuff that actually then makes life a lot easier. It might feel hard in the minute because you don't know what you're doing, but go and be open to learning. Once you know, it helps ease it, doesn't it?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. So what are some of the challenges that you've had with tech then?
Oh, the fact that I'm just, so old school with pen and paper. You can't see the desk right now, but it's just got pen. There's like pens and paper everywhere. So it's not being afraid of it, I think. I didn't understand it.
Yeah.
And I think what you don't understand, you're scared of. You are afraid of it because you don't want to get it wrong, or what if I fail? And all of it comes up in your head. So actually, I always say, the first thing you do anything, if you just accept you're going to suck at it and you're going to get it wrong and you're going to mess it up, then you suddenly become okay about it. Because then how we learn is through messing stuff up, because you think, oh, I'm not doing that again. What would I do differently? So to overcome it, I first had to just accept that I have absolutely no idea what I'm doing here. What do I need to go and find out about, and how do I need to go about it?
And it's like setting up the Calendly links, or you're setting up the automated payments, and just so to make it as easy for people to go from one step to the next to the next, to obviously then make that. Because, you know, those times when you'd be on the phone long time ago saying, oh, when are you free, and when are you, and then I'll check my calendar, but actually now you can ping a link out and say, right, you choose a day and time that's great for you, and then we'll go from there. And then if there's a conversation where we're working with someone or having that initial call, and then you can send the link straight over in terms of payment, and they can click that, and then once that's done, then obviously you can do the next bit. At the minute, we're just looking into I suppose, automating an audio program that we've got that's going to make that really simple for people to just, they don't even have to speak to us if they don't want to. It's going to be, hopefully, that's going to be the thing to help coach them as well. So bringing in these things is necessary, but we also feel like the human element can't be lost because, again, relationships, people don't just want to be non-contact or, you know, whatever we say, however fast automation goes and to improve certain aspects of life, we want to still maintain that balance of what it is to be human, which is to have those connections, you know.
Yeah, that's where I think you can, like, I've got a thing called 6-week surgery, which kind of puts in the foundations of what you need for business. Mm-hmm. But every week, so that a lesson will get released, say, on a Friday, on the Wednesday I'll do a Zoom call for whoever's on the course to come in so that they can ask the questions and mm-hmm. do what. And I think that's a really good blend of automating stuff, but also having that personal touch as well, so that people can do things. Yeah. So with you guys, what's the biggest lesson that you've learned off your kids?
Oh, off my kids. That you're not always right and to listen.
That they're their own people. As a parent, it's easy to think just because you played a part in creating them that you somehow think they're going to be just like you. and that they're going to think like you and do the things that you do. But of course, you've got to understand, we've had a long time and made a load of mistakes, so they're just kind of new into the game. So it's withholding judgment to the best of your ability, I think, which is not always easy because as a parent, you want your kids to be okay, and it's easy to get frustrated, isn't it, if you can see them doing things.
Oh, yeah.
The hardest thing, really, is shutting up.
Yeah, listening.
Just because I struggle with that one a lot because you want people to be okay, and if you can see them doing things that are not going to make them okay, you'd like trying to intervene, but all they'll do is resist you.
One of the hardest things, I think, is allowing them to fail as well. Yeah. I think we want them to be okay, and absolutely, I'm not saying fail as in they're going to go get themselves in a load of trouble, but allow them to fail and allow them to feel discomfort as well, because there's a lot of, you know, resiliency workshops and things, but you can't teach resiliency in a classroom. You learn to be resilient through experiencing the hardships in life. And so if you have forgotten your pencil case and you're going to get told off, or if you have forgotten something and you're going to get a detention from it, as a parent, what we want to do is fix it for them. We want to be like, oh, no, don't worry, I'll bring it in, and blah, 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 and so they don't get in trouble. But actually, it's allowing them to experience the discomfort, knowing that you're going to be there at the end of the day, and saying, yeah, that sucks, doesn't it? It doesn't feel good. Yeah. How did you end up in that situation? And what can you do to come through it so it doesn't happen again? Yeah. But I find that sometimes the hardest, that's to stand hardest. Back, knowing that you're not there to fix it for them. You're there to stand alongside them and guide them to fix it for themselves. Yeah. So that's the tricky
Being
one.
A man and having all the answers, Jamie, it's really annoying, isn't it? You know, you just can solve everyone's problems. They just won't listen. And
all these women.
Yeah, that's the most frustrating thing.
But then as a business owner, that's what we're in business to do, is to fix other people's problems.
Yeah.
So then when you think about your home life, you do, the amount of times Jack's forgot something, like his PE kit or something, or I'll run down the school, then puppy trainer's there. I just found that answer really interesting because I am that parent because I work from home. I'll put him in football situations where he can fail and where he has to take it on the chin, or we'll put Amelia in a performance situation where she'll go up for an audition and she might not get it and she has to deal with that rejection. Keeping them out of trouble and keeping them out of detention, I'm kind of okay. Grumble all the way down to the school and then sort it out for them.
Yeah.
I think we all do it, and even from a societal perspective, it's being done. It happens in schools now, so like the kids are getting more and more help than ever without being asked to contribute those little bits themselves. But while it works okay and we can feel better about ourselves, ultimately as they grow up, what skills are they going to not have that we had to learn because we were treated like that, weren't we? Where, you know, your mum said, or your dad said, well, that's your fault, it's unlucky, you know, and you have to cry and take it.
And you wouldn't forget it again.
And then you learn. So I think, you know, I don't know whether it's the societal need to, I don't know, is that, look, are we looking for acceptance then from and praise from other sources where now we'll overstep or step into a world where we'll try and solve all these problems because we want to feel better about ourselves as well. I always ask myself that question. Why am I doing that? What's my need to...
Who am I doing this for? We always say to parents, "Who, when you do anything, who are you doing it for?" And I've done it.
I do it.
We do it. I'm doing it for them. But actually, are we doing it for them? Or are we doing it for us to ease our unease with them being uncomfortable? Yeah. You know, who am I actually doing this for?
Yeah.
And it's a really great question. We have to ask ourselves all the time.
Because the other thing as well is we automatically have this thought that our kid is a representation of us. And so what will people think of us if our kids are...
Hasn't got the pee kit
or misbehaving. And that's another hard step to kind of come back from, to step back and think, well, if I'm doing the things that I know or want to do as a parent, I've still got to leave them to be that individual. And people might think that whatever they want about me as a parent, but that doesn't mean it's true. And that goes back to that bit of that self-esteem of knowing you've done the bit that you can do and it doesn't matter what other people say because actually it's just opinion. And it's that's the tough bit I find as a parent, is the letting go of what will people think of me if my kids are certain.
And this is all sort of age appropriate, isn't it? You ask them to do what they can do at a certain... Because we've got a vast array of ages. Yeah. So sometimes the older ones are, "Oh, that's not fair. She's not..." And I'm like, "She's 6 years younger than you." So it's all age appropriate here.
That's the conversation that I have lots with my kids, because my eldest is 15 and my youngest is 7. And then Amelia in the middle is 11. So I say to them regularly, "Jack, you get treated different to Amelia because you're older, more experienced, and therefore there are certain things that you should know and certain ways that you should behave. Yeah. Amelia, you get treated different to Charlie because you're older, you know more, and there's certain things that you should know." And I've had it on holiday where my mum and dad have kind of like, "Well, why has he got an iPad and being allowed to do that when Amelia and Jack aren't?" Because he's younger. And therefore, it makes life easier. Totally get that where you're coming from.
And you always say the margin for error gets less as you get a bit older, which it does, doesn't it? Yeah. So what we're finding is that we work sometimes a lot with 19, 20-year-olds, 21. So they have now become an adult, if you like, and they are now expected to adult. And they are sitting there and they are terrified of the world, not because of academically what they don't know, but how to function as themselves. They haven't got the high level of self-esteem or confidence. They've never had to go to the supermarket and shop for themselves. They've never had to wash up, change beds, do their own washing. So they're the basic levels, the basic needs, they cannot meet themselves because they've never been asked to take responsibility for them during childhood, if you like. And it's not to make them clean the house and all of that, no not at all, but what you can do, give it a go, because confidence then comes from what you do repeatedly over time. And once they are like, "Oh, do you know what, I can cook myself beans on toast," or "Do you know what, I do know how to wash up," or "I am all right going up to the till to pay for some stuff for myself," it just builds this self-esteem and confidence for them, so that when they face the world, they've got some basic skills.
Because the washing machine or the hob become the saber-toothed tiger from back in the dangers. So what we're seeing now with certainly younger people is the fear of failure means that they will freeze.
They won't try.
They'll close up shop, and they'd rather not fail. So they'd rather not even have a go because they might fail. And again, you can look at all the reasons for that in terms of technology, social media, people know when you fail now. Like that, when we were younger, if we failed, only your friends knew who were there. Now, thousands, millions of people can see your failure. So you can understand why the mind goes, "I'm going to protect myself. Why am I going to have a go at that when I might fail, look stupid, and then everyone will..." So it's understandable, but that's their equivalent of the saber-toothed tiger, is what's going to happen to me if I don't get this right. So the pressures on them are different, but we said every generation's faced pressure. It's just different all the time. So it's just trying to have that in our minds as well, that they're facing different pressures, but it's pressure nonetheless.
So the saber-toothed tiger really has become Instagram, TikTok and Facebook.
Yeah, I saw that somewhere. I said, our new dangers, our new threats to life for people's opinions, trolls online, being photographed and sent off, somebody shouting at you in the, you know, for road rage, people in the shops having a go. These are our new dangers in our mind. But obviously the mind responds to it in the same way as it would, because that's what it's programmed to do. Yeah.
So with social media and that, how do you regulate that with your girls? Do you allow them to use it and fail accordingly, or how's the parental relationship with that for you guys?
We've tried different. We've done different approaches. I think, like you said before, it's sometimes horses for courses, isn't it? It might be age appropriate. It might be character appropriate as well. Mm-hmm. But I think what we have talked about is the world that they're in. You could try and shield them all you want from it forever, but there's no guarantee that that's going to mean that they're going to be all right without exposure to it when they're older. So can you, I suppose, stand side by side with them in terms of helping them to navigate?
Asking them as well to regulate themselves online. So when you are online, how do you feel? If you feel all right, cool. Yeah. If you don't feel all right, you have a choice now. You are in full control of this device that you can put down, not use, block. So always that's that regulation of self. And as an adult, do it as well. Because I've had a client last week who said, oh, I'm following this page and it just makes me so sad all the time. And I'm like, unfollow it. Just unfollow it. She was like, oh, yeah. And it was as if, lovely, you know, as if she didn't realise she had the choice to not look at it. So we try and teach with the kids. My youngest loves FIFA on the, which Martin absolutely loves as well. Yeah. So the 9-year-old and Martin love a good game of FIFA. But when she starts to get cross with it, I say, if this is how it's making you feel, do you think maybe you should come off it? And she's like, oh yeah, and comes off and has a break. So it's teaching them
rather than
banning them and blocking it, because they're going to get it anyway. They're going to go and do it anyway.
Yeah.
How can you teach them to regulate themselves, understand themselves, how does it feel, and I have a choice now as to whether I interact with it or not.
We let Amelia have a phone a lot earlier than we did with Jack, strictly because of COVID. Because everyone was kind of insulated at home, so Jack had his phone when he was 10 in the last year of primary school, and that was the plan for Amelia, but because COVID hit, we allowed her to have a phone earlier. And it's interesting to kind of see some of the scrapes she gets into sometimes, and the arguments that she gets into as a child. And that's probably put me off allowing Charlie, my 7-year-old, having a phone until he's 10 again. That's not to say he doesn't use YouTube, and that's not to play. He doesn't do Roblox and games like that. But it's interesting how you change and adapt, really, isn't it? What about you guys? What's your relationship with social media like? Having to use it, obviously, as a business tool, sometimes can be quite frustrating, I feel, because I feel it ties you more to social media than you'd like to. Do you feel that?
I'm the same. I've got a real love-hate relationship with it, because I love it, because I love to, you know, it's the connection element, but I feel that... you're controlled, aren't you, by what gets seen, and it's not your final decision as to how much it gets shown and everything like that. So when it comes to social media, we do use it as a business tool mostly, don't we?
Yeah,
to
definitely.
Connect with people, to form that trust and get people to know us, people message us and share information. And I just treat it very much like that.
Yeah.
And I go on it certain times of day and I've become quite strict. Because how easy is it to get lost in... videos of dogs. Mine's dog videos. I love a dog video. And I can sit and watch all the rescue dog videos or the funny ones for ages. So when it comes to social media, we use it as a business tool. I would like to come away from it a little bit, if you like, and find alternative ways of connecting with people as well. So that's what we're in the process of doing too.
So do you do a lot of outside networking then, if you're trying to come away from social media? Do you go to a lot of networking events where you can meet people face to face?
We have done in the past, and that we've built a lovely sort of foundation for that. we find a lot of when it comes to sort of networking, it's a bit with what we do. People are a bit scared, which is I massively understand that. So when it comes to networking as such, we very much do it sort of on a like a one-to-one level. We'll have like chats with people one-to-one more than anything. People will reach out, we'll talk to them, and then they tend to then refer us privately rather than sitting in big groups and talking talking a bit.
Because again, who wants to admit that there's something wrong? Again, with that social media world, people very rarely want to put the those things on, do they? I think with the nature of what we do, people see our things and they'll maybe look and watch for a while, and then we'll maybe get the message, I've been watching you for a while, or I've had a, you know, so...
But we had no clue, they don't like or comment,
because
but they're watching.
The difficulty with some of the things that we put is that if you like some of our stuff, will all the people that you know think that's you and that you're maybe feeling that way? So I think for people's privacy, I think with what we do, it tends to be a little bit more behind the scenes than people to be openly go, oh yeah, that's me, or you know, comment on a post or something something like that. So
we get asked to talk places, so we do workshops and we do presentations or talk, you know, our talks for businesses and stuff. So that's very much how we network. And then nobody and then people get in touch with us later on, or so that's kind of how we network. Mm. Yeah.
I guess it must make it really hard to market then, because for me as a wedding entertainer, it's really easy to go on Facebook, target the right people on my ads, and then away you go, and everyone comments, likes and shares because it's all fun and it's all part of that big highlights reel on social media that we talk about. So how do you get around that?
We talk very much from a place of... this is how we've been there, so we've experienced this. So we talk very much from, this is how we feel. We talk about clients that come, never name them, it's all confidential. Mm-hmm. And how we get around it is we're just like very honest as well. We are very honest. Yeah. So we know how you're feeling. We know it's terrifying. We absolutely appreciate how scary it is to feel like you are stuck, or you're in this place of conflict with people all the time, and that you just generally your days just feel shit, like you'd wake up and you just cannot see anything. So we understand it. Now the next step is then for people to come forward, and again, I know myself when I was really struggling to ask for help is hard. And I saw somewhere that the three hardest things for humans to say is I'm sorry, I need help was one of them as well. Oh, and I don't know. Yeah. They were the three hardest things. So I'm sorry, I need help, and I don't know. They're the three hardest things that people struggle with. Yeah. So to say I need some help and I don't know what to do is a really
challenge
for people. So the way we do it, we put the messages out, we put loads of social media posts out just to say we get it and it's all right. You can't come to us with anything that we won't have heard of before. Yeah. And we don't judge you. We are all human beings going through this thing called life with challenges coming at us. How we deal with them is how we've dealt with them based off what we know. And what you don't know, what you don't know.
No.
And you will deal with them in the best possible way at that moment in time. And now if you look into help and maybe change how you're thinking and deal with it differently, we will sit alongside you and do that. No judgment, just support, guidance. And we do talk about love, because again, love is something that, and that's what lots of clients do comment on. That it's we try and make it as easy as possible for people to come to us initially, and then once they've got over that initial call, they tell us everything, and it's wonderful. They do. It's very open. You can share whatever. You know, as a midwife, I've learned that you cannot judge people's circumstances and decisions based off what you would do. It's not your place to ever say what anyone should or shouldn't do. But to sit alongside somebody and guide them as they're going through troubles, that's a lovely position to be in as well.
Yeah. It's almost like counselling is very akin to sales then. Because as a salesperson, you shouldn't be judgy. You should be there asking the right questions, listening to the right things, and then doing the right things to serve the customer. And it sounds like the synergy of those two things as things. So it's quite surprising neither of you have been in sales, really, that probably be rather good at it.
Yeah.
So we're coming towards the end of the podcast. So I've got a few quick-fire questions I'd like to ask if I can. What are the key three behaviours you would like to install into people?
So three key behaviours to install. I would say to trust yourself. Start to trust yourself.
Yeah.
Because that's a biggie, isn't it? People don't trust themselves.
Take responsibility.
Take responsibility, yeah.
Without blame and shame and all that. Yeah. And talk.
Be honest. So honesty, I think, is another one. We have a lot of people come and they are not just making excuses outside, but making excuses to themselves. Stop being honest with yourself. What does need to change? What do you need to do differently? Things like that. Because trust, on the other side of that, the feeling that you get from that is just brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was the first record you ever bought?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, wow. First record.
Did you buy a record? So was your CDs.
We joke about it.
I got vinyl. It might have been, I'm trying to think, it could have been Vanilla Ice.
Oh, Ice Baby.
Oh, nice. That could have been the first one, I think.
What was that?
Oh, was that 19, something like that. I think that might have been one of the first buys.
I think mine was an Oasis, like Wonderwall. Yeah.
Very, very good tunes. What's the most memorable place that you visited?
Cuba. I've been Cuba.
Lovely place.
Purely just because it's a very different...
Yeah.
Miami was mine.
Miami.
Yeah, yeah. Miami. I loved it. Yeah, it was something, just a nice vibe about it. Yeah.
I've been to both of those. Varavero's a lovely place.
Yeah.
We went there when Jack was two, and I think we ate out because he wasn't. He was in one of those stages where if you try staying out after half eight, he was just.
Yeah.
So we got out early doors, and the amount of lobster dinners we had that week in Cuba. And Miami's another place we've been to as well. Very, very cool places.
Yeah.
So what are your top three books?
Okay, go on then.
Mine's The Slight Edge, Jeff Olson, which is sat right here. Yeah. Have you ever read that? That's a great one.
Very good book.
Yeah, Slight Edge, Jeff Olson.
Yeah.
The Fifth Agreement,
Don Miguel Ruiz. The Untethered Soul by Michael Singer. Yeah.
Okay, I haven't heard of those two, so I'll have to take my reading list doing this podcast. Just keeps growing and growing.
Yeah.
So my last question is, Naomi and Martin, where can people find you?
Oh, yeah, we've got a website, which is www.just1to11itcoaching.co.uk, or... Facebook, we are all over that. Naomi Jordan and then Martin Pemberton, search us up.
Yeah.
And then that'll take you to the links to Instagram. We're all over social media, but they're probably the places that we're most present.
Amazing. Well, thank you very much for joining me and having a conversation with me today. It's been lovely. I've got loads of write downers that I'm sure other people have as well. Naomi and Martin, thanks for joining us on Tales of a Power Entrepreneur.
Thank you.